Hello, welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And this week we've been reading Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. But first, book news, and one of our favourite prizes, the long list has been announced. We don't normally really talk about long lists because it's so far from the big news of
the actual
prize.
And this one is enormous.
And it is 70 novels, and the Dublin Literary Award, books that are nominated, it's done with librarians all across the world. I've forgotten how many countries, but
there's about 30 or 40.
About 30 countries. Mm. So it includes novels in translation. So it's a very wide range. And I love the fact that they ask the librarians. And also it's a £100,000 prize. So it's also very generous. But I was impressed, Annie, unlike our usual track record where we've never heard of the books and we haven't much less read them, it might help that this one, they're looking at the previous year, I think. Remember, we've had this issue before, that it's books that we thought were...
Yes.
It goes back to sort of 2022 and possibly even 2021 first released. But we've read quite a few.
I thought so too.
Including Bodies of Light by Jennifer Down, Boller by, Pajtim Stotojti. And Cold
totally
Enough for Snow.
That,
no. And that's also translated by David Haxton, I think. Cold Enough for Snow by Jessica Au, which we'll talk about again in a moment. Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen. Devotion by Hannah Kent. I hope Devotion wins.
That'd be nice. I hope Bodies of Light wins, but...
Yeah. Lessons in Chemistry by...
Bonnie Garmus,
which has been... really successful.
Oh, and being made into a TV show as we speak. And
oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
it's
fantastic.
Be great.
Love Marriage by Monica R. Lee. Matrix by Lauren Groff. Paradise by Fernanda Melchor, translated by Sophie Hughes. Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. Mm-hmm. We're very on point
we
today.
Are.
And Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan, which we just did recently. The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak, which I really loved. The Magician by Colm Toybean, one of my top books of... It was the year before last.
Yeah,
it was one of my top books of 2021. The Sentence by Louise Erdrich and The Trees by Percival Everett. So we've actually done...
quite a
very
few.
Well, and it just shows the quality of the list because all of those... Most of those books we really loved, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. When it makes you look at the rest of the list, there's some I've never heard of and I'd love to go back and look at those, and then there's some that I thought, oh, I'd love to read that at the time and then totally forgot about it. So, yeah it's a great list. Have a
even
look.
Boller, you know, I still think about Boller. That was
I recommended it to one of our book clubs and thought, oh, it's a bit heavy. I don't know how if they'll go for it, but they've been reading it and really loving it. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to talk about in there.
It's a very rich, beautifully written book, isn't it? There was one that I starred, which is Love in the Big City by Sang-young Park, translated by Anton Her. And that looks really, I was going to say fun, but that looks like a great read, set in Korea, and it's Tilted Axis Press, which is Deborah Smith's press. And there was one other that I starred. Oh, Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doer. I have had that highly recommended to me by someone I trust, and I've suggested it to Annie. Annie said you didn't get on with it.
I didn't finish it. I read half of it.
Oh, you read half?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say another person who recommended it to me as well recently said it's hard to get into, but once you get into it, it's fantastic.
Oh,
so
too many characters and too much backstory for my liking.
Yeah. Oh, now I'm even
funny.
More intrigued.
Yeah, I don't know. Give it a go.
I'm going to give it a
go.
It
is very long, but I've also had people rave about it. And one man told me it was the best book he'd ever read.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. He's a beautiful writer. Like, the sentences are lovely, but it was a bit much for me.
This will be intriguing. Mm. Yes. So that is the Dublin International Literary Award, just a taster for the sort of books that might win. We love that one. And there's another one that's been announced.
Yeah. So recently the Victorian Premier's Literary Award was announced, and there are a few great books on there, but the one I wanted to highlight was Jessica Au's Cold Enough for Snow, which is on the Dublin Award as well. She also was the first winner of the Novel Literary Prize and has been getting a lot of accolades, which is always great to see for an Australian author and for such a tiny little small book, you know, like it could be overlooked, I think, really easily, but I'm really glad that it's getting the attention it deserves. And that prize is $100,000, the Victorian VPLA. So,
and she won that
She won the top prize. So, yeah, I'm thrilled for her. And then, you know, it obviously translates into sales and that kind of thing as well. So,
and this week we've been reading Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. So she probably doesn't need much introduction, but Annie, what can you tell us about Emily?
She's a Canadian author and she's published 6 novels, probably most well known for Station 11, which came out several years before the pandemic and covers a pandemic. And then the pandemic happened and she kind of rocketed into stardom all over again. That's had a Netflix series made about it. And this is her most recent novel, Sea of Tranquility, which is a kind of follow-up or a connected novel with her previous novel, Glass Hotel, which came out early 2020.
We did Glass Hotel on the podcast, I think.
It was interesting because I love her. I've read everything she's written and I read that in a really disrupted time. You know, it was kind of March 2020 and I couldn't get my head in the right space and I didn't get on with it really. And I remember you quite liked it.
I loved it. It was an interesting one to discuss because I think it's been described as kaleidoscopic because it was fragmented. Mm. I absolutely loved it. But at the end of it, I think you made the comment that it didn't kind of stick with you because it was so fragmented. Mm. And I thought, oh, probably I felt a bit the same, but I just really enjoyed reading it.
When I think my memory of reading it was I struggled to kind of keep the strands together. So this book has several characters from that novel, but not in an overt kind of way. You don't need to have read that one to read this one. I think they work quite well as a pair. This one jumps about 100 years forward in time over 4 or 5 timelines. So we start in 1912 with a man called Edwin St. John St. Andrews, who has travelled from England to Canada to kind of make his fortune or...
Well, he's been exiled there.
He's the second son. He doesn't have any inheritance and he's annoyed his parents by his political views. So he's kind of been shipped off. And in the wilderness, he experiences this really dislocating anomaly, I guess. He almost slips out of time and he starts fearing for his mental health. And then we jump forward 100 years and we're in almost the present day, in a club watching a video that Vincent filmed. Yeah, what we get from that is that she had filmed this event or, you know, she has a record of it on film. We jump forward again to a novelist in the 2100s who's on her last book tour of Earth talking about a pandemic novel as a pandemic is sweeping the Earth again. And then we jump forward again to 2400 and this kind of mysterious time-travelling fellow who has appeared in each of the previous scenes gives us his life story. And then you kind of work backwards back through those timelines. So, yeah, the structure is really interesting. I think there's lots about the world being in crisis and always feeling like it's almost the end of the world, all these kind of earth-shattering moments, but they take place across about 5 centuries. What did you think?
Oh, I loved it. Great. I loved it. There are obviously some hesitations because of this element of science fiction or dystopia
that
we'll get to, as you can imagine. But the thing about Emily St. John Mandel is she's one of those authors, and we've talked about Station 11, which I think is a modern classic now, and The Glass Hotel, that you can – I would follow her wherever she goes because it's all about the story and the characters and you're just – she really –
they're very human, aren't they?
She's so good at – getting characters that you warm to and they're very human. So you feel very grounded and she just takes you on into a story. So that's what I love about her writing. And then you can just ignore the fact that there's a spaceship departing over on the side of the screen, so to speak. So I really loved it. And so it was actually a much sort of lighter, easier read than I'd expected.
I
didn't know if I was getting into something more I shouldn't have. I should have known, knowing her, but I thought it might be a bit heavier or more dystopic than it felt. So the tone is really warm. Her writing is so fluid and really succinct. So she just gives you just enough detail to really place you in the scene. So Edwin on the ship, the first page, you completely understand where you are. He's on the ship. He's going to Vancouver, not by choice, and he's 18 and so what's going to happen? And you just have enough detail to really want to know what happens next and just enough of his character to sort of wonder what will happen to him. Mm. And then you get to the boarding house, and then he sort of decides it's quite nice just hanging out at the boarding house, and he has this inertia. And then on page, it's only about page 3, Reginald arrives. It was clear, you know, that Reginald was a man not prone to inertia. and then, you know, the next morning you see Reginald's already setting off, so he drags Edwin along. So it's only a couple of pages, in like a lot of action.
But
happens.
You've already got the character as well by that point. You know, in three pages you kind of have this idea of this person.
It's beautifully done. Mm. I don't know how much editing goes into that, whether she writes much longer and then cuts it back, or whether she just naturally is
at
so
that level now.
Fluid. Mm. But the quality is exquisite. And then, yeah, she gives you the characters. So there's Reginald, there's Olive, the author, who's on the book tour. And you can imagine, because her own experience goes into it, and Olive had a bestseller that was about a pandemic. So now, you know, she's still talking about it, and that rings true to Emily St. John Mandel's own experience, I'm sure. And there's just beautiful snippets of the book tour to give you such a sense of what would be about a 2 or 3 month journey into a few pages. And just that show, so she'll do the talk and then she'll be at a different hotel each night. And so that night the hotel room was black and white and she went to sleep dreaming of chess. And then another few days go by, and then...
And the different people in the signing queues, I loved those.
The signing queues and the questions. So what, someone asks her a question, but it's more like a comment, that it's like, I thought the book ended too abruptly. And then it's then she says, you know, Olive fretted for days, you know, she spent the next 3 days wondering if the book ended too abruptly, because of course that would play on her mind. And then that night, the next day, she's in Texas or something, that night Olive got out of bed and bumped into a side table because she still was thinking of the layout of the room the previous night, and she starts to get more and more exhausted. So it's only a sentence here, a sentence there, but you get this real sense of being on this book tour with her.
And the fatigue of talking about the same thing over and over again. You can see how authors just get sick of their own work. The one where she goes to the mystery festival and they ask her mystery questions and they say, what's your favorite alibi? And she was like, I don't know. And then they ask her something else, and then they say, sex with handcuffs or without? And she's kind of like, no comment. Yeah.
So and the thing is, an author writing about a book tour could be quite dreary.
And I know how you feel about books within books.
And insular and or boring. But she just does it with such a light touch and really makes you feel like you're there with the character. But it's really pacey at the same time as her getting more and more fatigued. The writing of it is really well paced.
I think the fragments that annoyed me in Glass Hotel, because that was very much one chapter was with one character and then you jump to another person. You're always disoriented, you never know where you are. Whereas this, you kind of have 20 or 30 pages with each person and you kind of get a bit grounded in their world and you get to know them, and then you kind of jump to the next person. So it's not quite so disorienting. And I think you get to sink into their world a little bit more and you know what's coming, you know you're going to be moved again.
Yes.
But once they reappear, you kind of have a bit more of a solid grasp on them. Whereas in Glass Hotel, I just was always kind of clutching at straws and felt like the ground was never stable beneath me. So, yeah, I think I appreciated, even though this is written in little fragments, the fragments are grouped together more.
It's fewer jumps to deal with, but the jumps are much bigger because we're jumping in time now, so it's quite difficult for me to get my head around. But, yeah, I loved the different characters and just the way she captures even the ending of a relationship. She does in 2 lines, I think, when Mirella ends her relationship with Louisa, who's clearly just not the right fit for her, not suitable, and you can see that they're not getting along. So I think she kisses Louisa goodbye and then she knows that it's over.
Yeah.
And she says, adio. And Louisa, who doesn't understand French and doesn't get the reference, you know, walks off. And even in that one line, you think, well, they weren't suited to each other because Louisa just didn't get it. You know?
One thing, sometimes you do get those blasts of clarity that you're just kind of like, oh, I hate the way this person chews. You know, like we can't continue.
We can't continue. But it's so succinct. Yeah. I really love it. And then the way she imagines the future, what I had some issues with it, but what I loved about it was it makes you sort of feel a warmth towards human beings as a species, mm-hmm. in the sense that they are constantly trying to adapt. You might say, on the whole, we're not doing it very well at the moment if you look at climate change. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to imagine the sorts of futures that might evolve because of climate change, among other reasons. And just that thing, which I think is very human, that it ends up being quite terrible, but they just get on with it anyway. They'll just get on with the day. People sort of, it becomes the new normal, I guess.
That's what I think I like about her kind of futurism, that it's just people have already adapted to it. And the same thing in Station 11, where it's kind of 20 years post-pandemic, you don't get all that terror and the uncertainty of the early days. You kind of get people who know what it's like and they've made meaning from it and they've kind of put it to bed, and this is what they have to deal with now in their day-to-day. And that's, I think, an amazingly human quality, that we can adapt so quickly. And we've seen that in the last few years, that what would have once seemed so far-fetched now is just totally normal. And I think we have this amazing ability to just absorb new information and then kind of make it into the, okay, well, that's what happens now.
Yeah.
And I think it's also a more optimistic future than lots of the kind of dystopian or truly dystopian books, because I don't think this is dystopian.
I thought it was very dystopian. I mean, it could be worse.
I think we're still here.
I think the more pessimistic would be that humans are totally extinct, and I'm sure that's a real possibility. Mm. But apart from that, in terms of us still living, the world she describes is not one any of us would want to be in. So just to be clear for the listeners, there's no real sky. They have to move to the moon, the plot spoiler, but I think that's implicit in the blurb. So that you're on the moon with no sky, so they have a fake sky, they have fake rain.
But I think, as one of the characters says, even if you know you're living in a simulation, you kind of get used to that and it's your day-to-day.
Well, that's true.
If you hadn't known any different,
maybe that would be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't appeal to me
at all. Like, I think the abrupt shift from where we are now to 300 years in the future. But I think even the fact that there are people still 300 years in the future and that they're making livings for themselves.
That's the optimistic part.
Yeah, so.
But I found one of the things I have trouble with when you start going into futuristic, and it's the same with Clara and the Sun, is when an author has to imagine what would that be like, immediately I think you run into problems. Mm. So, for example, in this one you've got time travel, but the rules are that if you go back in time, like Gasparri does, so he's going back to investigate whether there's a glitch in the universe and there are other universes going on, and is it all a simulation, and it sort of, your head
bit
will
of a
hurt
mind
if,
trip,
you, yep. if you think about that too much. So I just let that go over my head. But he goes back in time, but the rule is you're not allowed to change the course of history. So if you know, you go to a party and you know someone might die next week because they're going swimming, you can't say to them, don't go swimming next week or something like that. You can't save people, in other words. And I just have, there are so many issues with that. One is, as if people would follow the rules, why would he follow the rules? And then they try to have all these consequences and, you know. But also I think just someone else being in a room at a party changes the course of history, because without Gasparri doing anything at all, Annie is at the party, she sees him across the room, ditches her fiancé, gets together with Gasparri. The fiancé then goes on to take revenge by doing, you know, blowing up the office building or something. Who knows what.
Or even so small as, I don't talk to someone at that party that I would have otherwise talked to. And, you know, I know what you mean. There's the butterfly effect.
When you start thinking it through, it doesn't make sense and it can't work, or not work in the way that these characters want it to work. And then the other thing that grated a tiny bit on, but it might have been quite deliberate, was in Olive's book tour. So she's meant to be 100 years into the future. So I think there's travel, they're living on the moon at this point, might be 200
Earth.
Years.
Yeah.
This is the sort of, they're living on the moon, but she's still doing book tours on Earth. So a bit like traveling from one country to the other. So they've got moon life, life on the moon, and yet her taxi driver is still mansplaining to her, or she's still getting asked questions on the book tour about, how are you managing to juggle your career with your, you know, looking after your child, and she's still really annoyed that they wouldn't ask that of a man. And that might be a very deliberate thing that, yeah. that Emily St. John Mandel's, that's what I call pessimistic about the future.
Yeah, I guess
but
so.
It also didn't ring true to me, because I thought if you look at the arc of history over a 100 or 200 year period, you do see progress towards equality. So I would have, if on that trend, you would not have this the sort of issues. And then the fact she's still got taxi drivers when you've clearly would have self-driving cars by that point. We're talking 200 years into. I love that she did have taxi drivers because that was more human.
Yeah. And maybe, I don't quibble with those kind of things. No, I don't know. It doesn't bother me.
It doesn't detract from the reading of the book, which is completely immersed myself in it and enjoyed it. But that's the sort of reason that I don't go for. Only Emily can do it, really. I can't do those futuristic.
Yeah. Because it's interesting because to me the tech was so light. Like, she didn't explain, especially with the time travel stuff, you know, they don't try and go into the heavy science of it or, you know, how it works, how got here. No. And that's what I mean by that normalcy of it. People were just kind of like, oh, well, that's a thing. That's a thing that we have. And like with Wi-Fi, I don't understand how Wi-Fi works. I don't understand how half the things we have these days work.
I'm on board with that to that extent because it could be possible when you're talking 200 years into the future. So some of the things, you know, the spaceships and that all very much could be possible. So you're right. She just includes it, incorporates it into the story in a really seamless way, and it is plausible. So it's just that when you start thinking about it too much, it's
don't think about it too much.
It hurts,
I think,
your brain.
Yeah, I think especially the way she wraps it all up, which is very neat and tidy, I think also has that kind of quality of like a David Mitchell novel or somewhere like that, where there's so many threads and they manage to pull them all together quite neatly. And I just think, is that how the world works? I don't know. That sometimes has galls me a little bit. I didn't mind it in this because I think it would have been quite unsatisfying if you hadn't had a conclusion to this anomaly that's been happening, and why has it been happening, and what's going on, and what's all the time travel for. So I quite liked that she wraps that up. But yeah, it's an interesting debate about whether you leave a book unfinished, like the person at her book tour accuses her of, or whether you wrap it all up in a neat bow and kind of put a lid on it.
Yes.
It's I can go with it, you know. She takes me there and I can imagine it and it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
Well, and I also think I like her kind of appreciation of the fact that, you know, especially in the author tour bit where she's touring the earth and there's a book about a pandemic and then a pandemic happens – we just refuse to learn from our mistakes, or we just seem to be incapable of thinking, well, this has happened before and we'll get through it. You know, every time we have a crisis, it's like the newest crisis is the worst crisis because it's happening to us. And that, I don't know, there's something about people where we never think tragedy is going to hit us personally, you know, that again, something that our brains does, that kind of brains do, that insulate us from all the bad things that could happen, because how could you get through your day otherwise if you didn't just cut it all off and think, oh, well, that won't happen to me or my family.
But that's rational as well.
Well, it's, I don't know. Is it? It's protective.
Protective. Yeah. Yeah. So, no, I really loved it. I mean, you know, when I say quibbles, we know that I'm not into this sort of science fiction. But it didn't read as a science fiction book. Really enjoyed it. I highly recommend.
Great.
And you too?
Yeah, I did. I loved it a lot more than Glass Hotel, and it made me want to go back to Glass Hotel and kind of look for those similarities and maybe read it in a more stable timeline in my own life.
It also makes you appreciate the wilderness and nature without her saying anything about that, which I think has so much more impact than a more preachy
book. She's a beautiful writer of brevity.
It just makes you stop and think. You want to protect trees and proper skies and proper rain, and
it's not didactic, you know, ocean, at all, is it?
Because you don't want that world that she describes, but she never says that. It's just leaves it for the reader to think, oh, I really do like a real tree, you know, or a real wilderness. So, yeah, I love that about it as well. It makes you reflect a little bit. So that was Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. So next up I might delve into Cloud Cuckoo Land. Let's see how we go. That will take me more than a week though. We'll have to come back to you on what's coming up next. We might do a special Keep or Cull episode because I've been doing a lot of rampaging through the shelf.
And I have a new bookshelf coming which will require me to cull some.
Fantastic.
Yes, a stable one that kind of attaches to the wall.
A new bookshelf should mean you're adding to your storage.
No,
space.
No. Oh. I have to change the one that's currently there.
Oh, no.
Well, so, yeah, we'll be downsizing.
Well, we can help you with
that'll
that.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that will be coming up. I'm looking forward to that one. We want photos.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And in the meantime, you can email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us. I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras and Annie.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Mr_Annie.
And we're on Facebook at Books on the Go. And please rate and review us as well, because that helps people find the podcast. So we really appreciate that. Thank you. And we will see you next week. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.